This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiji Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
For 3 years, northern Mozambique has been a hotbed of activity by a shadowy Islamist militant group. Their attacks have led to the displacement of more than 400,000 people and the deaths of more than 2,000 in the Cabo Delgado region.
That's VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg on the deteriorating situation in Mozambique. Details coming up. Also, economists are criticizing Nigeria's decision to devalue its currency. And Malawi has seen a drop in confirmed COVID-19 infections. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We begin with our top story, where the Ethiopian government yesterday admitted that its troops shot at a United Nations team visiting refugees in Ethiopia's war-torn Tigray region. Reuters reports the UN security team was seeking access to the Shimbela camp for Eritrean refugees when they were fired at on Sunday. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric said there were four people in the UN team assessing roads in the area for aid deliveries. The shooting incident, he said, were alarming, and that the UN is engaged at the highest level with the federal government to express its concern and avoid any such incidents in the future. The spokesman pointed out that the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has spoken with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on Monday. Radian Hussein, spokesman for the Ethiopian Government Task Force for Tigray, told reporters yesterday that the UN team passed through two checkpoints without stopping while driving hastily to an unauthorized area. He said Ethiopian troops began shooting when the UN team was about to break the third checkpoint. And from more news from the Horn, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is in Kenya today for a working visit. Upon arrival, he was welcomed by Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. Abiy and Kenyatta are expected to inaugurate the 500-kilometer Hawassa-Moyale Road project as part of the Lamu Port, South Sudan-Ethiopia Transport Corridor. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, calls the volatile situation in Ethiopia very worrying and fears it will spiral out of control. She is calling for humanitarian access to the region. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Despite Ethiopian government claims to the contrary, High Commissioner Bachelet says fighting continues between Ethiopian armed forces and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, as well as affiliated militia on both sides. She says human rights monitors and aid agencies are unable to access this volatile area. That means they are unable to fully verify disturbing allegations of violations against civilians caught in this chaotic situation. However, she believes the information her office has received to be credible.
We have corroborated information of gross human rights violation abuses, including indiscriminate attacks against civilians and civilian objects, looting, abductions, and sexual violence against women and girls. We have also reported forced recruitment of Tigrayan youth to fight against their own communities.
The High Commissioner says there's an urgent need for independent monitoring of the situation in Tigray. She's calling on the government to grant access to the region to ensure protection for the civilian population and to bring those responsible for abuse to account. Bachelet notes the humanitarian situation in the region also is distressing. She is appealing to the government to implement an agreement with the UN to grant aid agencies unimpeded access to civilians in desperate need of assistance. Elsewhere in Ethiopia, Rights Chief Bachelet says there are numerous reports of ethnic profiling of Tigrayans. She says Tigrayans reportedly have been dismissed from jobs in the civil service, journalists are harassed, and hate speech directed against people of Tigrayan origin is growing.
I think that such discriminatory actions are deeply unjust, but are also fostering divisiveness and sowing the seeds for further instability and conflict. So I urge the government to take immediate measures to halt such discrimination.
Bachelet expresses concern about a reported rise in intercommunal violence in recent weeks in other parts of Ethiopia. She says fighting, which has flared up in Amhara, Benishangwe Gumuz, Somali, Afar, and Oromia regions, reportedly has resulted in fatalities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Ghana's preliminary election results are delayed. Election authorities aimed to have the results by Tuesday evening, and the country's election commission has not announced when it thinks voters can anticipate the outcome. Ghanaian voters are choosing between 12 presidential candidates and members of parliament for residents in 275 districts. The poll represents a tight battle between President Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party and his rival John Mahama of the National Democratic Congress Party. Hundreds of supporters of Cameroon's opposition leader Maurice Kamto have gathered at his home after his month-long de facto house arrest suddenly ended. Heavily armed police stationed at his home since September 22nd, left on Tuesday, but authorities are giving no explanation. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Maurice Kamto's supporters flocked to his home after heavily armed police left the opposition leader's house Tuesday night, ending a month-long de facto house arrest. Cameroon authorities gave no immediate explanation for why police left or if Kamto would face any charges from the September protest that prompted the detention. Among the hundreds of Kamto supporters is 19-year-old Ernestine Nanga, who says she is anxious to see him free.
When I heard that the police left the house of our political leader, Maurice Kamto, I came here to know if our political leader, Maurice Kamto, is in good heart, to know the plan he has for our country. Thirdly, I want to hear from him. I want him to address us Cameroonians.
Christopher Ndong is Secretary General of Kamto's Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party. He says the opposition leader is in good health and will be addressing his supporters at what he calls an appropriate moment. Ndong called on the government to release some 130 Kamto supporters and party officials who were among hundreds arrested in September for rebellion and illegal assembly.
We are looking forward for them to release the leaders of the executive organ and many others who make this government know that there should be meaningful and true democracy, that political parties should be free to hold meetings, manifestation, associate with other political parties, create coalition, and that the electoral system be revised and then an electoral code done which will be suitable for everybody.
In a press release late Tuesday, government spokesman René Emmanuel Sadi said those arrested would face the law. Sadi said they are accused of rebellion, attempted revolution, and illegal assembly for a September 22 protest against President Paul Biya and holding regional elections. Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says Cameroon's first regional elections held Sunday shows that people trust Biya and his government.
Everyone knows that in democracy, political or Republican legitimacy is acquired through the ballot box. Refusing to participate in elections and claiming to defend the interests of Cameroonians without any elective mandate is a scheme that cannot work in Cameroon. We will not allow that to happen.
The opposition argues election laws favor the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement Party and Biya, who has been in power for nearly four decades. In January 2019, authorities detained Kamto and 200 of his supporters for insisting that Biya stole the 2018 presidential election from him. International pressure led Biya to pardon Kamto after he'd spent 9 months in prison. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé. Cameroon.
A top U.S. counterterrorism official has expressed concern about the deteriorating situation in Mozambique, where an Islamic State-affiliated group has captured territory in the country's northeast. But, says Ambassador-at-Large Nathan Sales, a military solution is not the answer. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
For 3 years, northern Mozambique has been a hotbed of activity by a shadowy Islamist militant group. Their attacks have led to the displacement of more than 400,000 people and the deaths of more than 2,000 in the Cabo Delgado region. But, as a top U.S. counterterrorism official says, this conflict affects much more than a rural corner of one southern African nation. The conflict has recently spread to neighboring Tanzania, raising the potential of dragging the region into instability and boosting a group with declared ties to the Islamic State. Ambassador-at-Large Nathan Sales, the U.S. coordinator for counterterrorism, recently visited Mozambique and South Africa to see how the U.S. can help, as he said, contain, degrade, and defeat the growing movement. With a situation this complicated, he said, a military solution is not enough. He spoke to reporters Tuesday via teleconference from Washington.
In addition to the security challenges posed by ISIS actors there, we also have the knock-on consequences from a humanitarian standpoint, with hundreds of thousands of Mozambican citizens fleeing the violence. And so part of the response has to include meeting that humanitarian need. We have to get the security situation under control so that people feel comfortable and safe returning to their homes, returning to their lives. The United States has been very active over the years, and especially recently, in devoting resources to help address the humanitarian situation in Cabo Delgado. And we'll look to continue to do so, partnering not just with government entities, but with NGOs that have access and expertise that we need to rely on.
Alex Vines, director of the Africa program at Chatham House, said there are several reasons the world is paying attention to this small corner of Africa. For one, Cabo Delgado has vast, still untapped oil and gas deposits estimated to be worth $60 billion. Instability has prevented those from being developed. And he adds the militant group is getting bolder, helped by the failures of the Mozambican government.
So there's local grievance. There's real frustration that the Mozambican state, the party of government in particular, has not delivered. So disenfranchised, frustrated young people. And I think also that the impact of the cyclone last year in the far north there, so Cyclone Kenneth, that the poor humanitarian response also drove people into becoming more sympathetic to this insurgency. So it's a mixture of all these things, and there's not one key driver. But what's worrying is that it's also a magnet attracting radical jihadists who have been operational elsewhere, looking at Cabo Delgado as maybe a new potential theatre for them. And that's particularly worrying, and hence why a U.S. official has been visiting Mozambique to discuss this issue with the Mozambican authorities.
So what are the outlines of the U.S. plan on that? Sales was vague.
What we need to do is make sure that we in the United States are making available to our Mozambican partners every capability that we have to help them degrade and ultimately defeat that terrorist threat. I think you can expect that these conversations will continue into the future as we look to match American capabilities to Mozambican needs. And of course, we want to work very closely with our partners. Once we have reached a consensus, once we have reached an agreement on what our partnership could look like, the precise contours of what that partnership could look like, I'm sure we'll be in a position to share more information about what that will look like.
The U.S. is not the only outside party trying to intervene. This week, Pope Francis donated $121,000 to support victims of militant attacks in Cabo Delgado. Those funds will be used to build health facilities for the displaced. And Vines noted mercenaries with the shadowy Wagner group arrived in Mozambique in late 2019 to help Mozambican security forces. Top U.S. military officials have echoed analysts who believe the Wagner group is closely connected to the Kremlin, a charge Russian officials have denied. Mozambique has also been in talks with Britain and neighboring South Africa for possible support in combating the growing insurgency. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
U.S. President Donald Trump's order for most U.S. troops to leave Somalia comes as the country prepares to hold parliamentary election this month and presidential election in February of next year. Our very own Vincent McCourty has the details.
Speaking via Skype from Mogadishu, the former deputy director of Somalia's intelligence agency, Abdusalam Yusuf Gullet, says the timing is unfortunate.
I think it's not right at the moment. Given the time of the Somali and the elections, Somalia is having a general election now, and Al-Shabaab are engaging in so more violent and fight against the Somali securities. So I don't think it's an interest to the Somali government, interest to the Somali security. And it doesn't have interest in anyone. So I think it's a heartbreaking, the Somali security and the system that we rely on.
Gullet says the U.S. decision is good news for Al-Shabaab, which he worries will launch fresh attacks against African Union and Somali government targets.
Al-Shabaab is a victory. I'm sure they celebrate it. I'm sure they look in the clock, ticking the clock. 15 January, I think that's a day had been given to the Americans withdrawn. And I think Al-Shabaab will be celebrating. I think they will, you know, make sure I think they will show off in the coming weeks and their military capability, which they've not been using for years. And that's, it's a good news for Al-Shabaab. Of course, on the other side, it's a bad news for the Somali government and AMISOM. And for those who are fighting against Al-Shabaab and terrorist extremists in East Africa, it's a sad news for the American withdrawal.
In addition to training Somali troops, Gullet says U.S. forces also play a critical role in operating armed drones that he says have degraded Al-Shabaab's operations.
If the drone is withdrawn from Somalia and American is hovering above the airs of Somali, you know, Al-Shabaab bases, if that minimized, Al-Shabaab will be able to use all their capability, military capability, and they will be able to engage and cause them more casualties. The African unions and the Somali securities, and I'm sure they will be more visible in the coming weeks if they realize the Americans are not watching them overhead.
That is Abdusalam Yusuf Gullet, the former deputy director of Somalia's intelligence agency, speaking to VOA's Vincent McCourty. Economists are criticizing Nigeria's decision to devalue its currency, the Naira. Officials say it is an effort to avoid a looming recession, but entrepreneurs say the action further worsens economic conditions for citizens and businesses already reeling from the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, restrictions, and corruption. The currency now exchanges for 500 Naira to $1. The action by the Central Bank of Nigeria is the third time the Naira would be officially devalued this year. Analysts say the government earned less revenue from oil sales, and an expected pay increase for workers after months of strike will further deplete its reserves. The government says it is taking steps to cushion the effects of the devaluation on the poor by investing more in agriculture and infrastructure. VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Uche Onyegbuorcha, former member of the Federal House of Representatives, who says the action will further worsen poverty in the country.
Effects that you think this devaluation might bring?
It will increase poverty, and it will mean that more of the few industries that are left are going to have to collapse. That would mean more people going into the unemployment market, and that means that even drugs, most of which are imported into this country, will not be affordable to the ordinary people, and that is why these days many sick people are resorted to and spiritualists to treat themselves. So that what it means is that this situation is going to worsen and life will be very, very difficult to sustain by the ordinary people.
What do you make of the timing of the devaluation?
It shows how insensitive the government capacity of creating social tension. Most of the workers are on strike. The academic staff, you know, of university lecturers have been on strike since January. The NLC is threatening strike in several areas. So most of the workers in the different unions are already on strike across the nation.
Do you think the government has any other alternative than to devalue the currency?
I believe there are several alternatives, but it requires that the government has to look inwards. Two, the government has to have a homegrown approach of response to the situation. Basically, our economy has been such where the non-traditional sectors have never been able, and this has always meant that the wrong indices used to calculate the Nigerian economy.
That's Uche Unyu Gorcha, former member of the Federal House of Representatives, speaking with VOA's Chinedu Ofor from Lagos. Malawi has seen a drop in confirmed COVID-19 infections despite increasing numbers of people ignoring rules on social distancing, wearing masks and washing hands. As Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, some worry the growing complacency could lead to a second wave of the virus.
Juliet Masamba, a secondary school in Ndilande Township, stopped wearing a face mask in September after Malawi's government reopened the schools and airports and lifted restrictions on social gatherings. She says this is because the COVID-19 cases here in Malawi are going down. Even the statistics of those who are dying of the disease are not threatening. This makes me believe that the outbreak is gone and cannot come back. Malawi has for the past 3 months registered a dramatic drop in coronavirus infections from a total of 1,065 active cases on October 3rd. The country's total caseload has dropped to just 45 as of December 7. More than 5,000 people have recovered, while the death toll stands at 185. New confirmed cases are now ranging between 1 and 4 per day. Sometimes days pass without a recorded infection. Maziko Matemba, who heads Malawi's Health and Rights Education Program, attributes the drop in new infections to declining COVID-19 testing.
Our testing capability is not as high as we'd expect by now, because we haven't even hit 50,000 or 100,000. By now, if we would have maybe 1 million people tested, but you know, our testing is targeted.
Malawi, with a population of 18 million, is currently only testing those with COVID-19 symptoms, largely because of shortage of testing kits. Dr. Charles Mansambo is a principal secretary in the Ministry of Health. Dr. Mansambo says the testing drop is because of the government's early enforcement of measures like closing schools, restricting public gatherings, and mandating people to wear a face mask in public places. But he says he worries about growing complacency in Malawi.
You know, that's a big concern. We're not out of the woods yet. I mean, we still have COVID around, and we have to follow all the public health measures that we put in place. We've seen that people have a lot, which is very dangerous for us. We still have the virus around, and it's got that potential of spreading very quickly, and we cannot afford a second wave.
Meantime, Malawi's government has intensified its campaign to remind people on the need to adhere to all COVID-19 preventive measures, like hand washing, observing social distancing, and wearing face coverings. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice.